All right, you guys. It gives me great honor to introduce our speaker for tonight, which is Sarah.
Hey, Sarah Alcoholic. I have a sobriety date, and that's January 30th of 06. I've got a sponsor, Francine. She has a sponsor. I've got a home group, which is the Golden Group. I have a group of women in my life that are absolutely crazy insane, so they get me. Did anybody see the sunset tonight?
Yes.
And the cloud formation that was out there? That was just so beautiful. I'm cruising up college to get here, and I'm looking at it, and it's like, thank you, God. Thank you, God, for creating that so that I could see it at that time. You know, being right here, right now, at this moment, I got to see that. And those are things that I never bothered to look at in my disease. I was born in Michigan to a biological mother and father that I have never met. I was adopted to the wonderful parents that I have, a loving, loving couple. I used to say that what they got was a broken child, but I was corrected. What they got was a child who was wired differently. I wasn't broken. I was wired differently. And they did the best that they could with what they were given. You know, children don't come with an instruction book. And I was the type of child, I was colicky. I didn't want to be held. I had... I just was, as a child, an infant. My parents had put in to get a third child. My brother was, they had gotten him 18 months previous. He was six months old when they adopted him. I was an infant, and they immediately had put in for another child. And after 6 months of me, they withdrew that application. So they had two children to raise. We moved from Michigan to Florida when I was an infant. I don't remember Michigan. My only memories of Michigan is when we went back, and we were the crazy tan kids from Florida at Christmas time, climbing on those huge piles of dirty snow that they scooped out of the parking lots, and all the natives there were like, okay, they're weird. But that was like snow. Ooh, cool stuff. 10 years in Florida, my parents were wonderful. They had a solid marriage. They were married 63 years at the time of my father's death. I was raised with a faith. I was born into the Lutheran religion and faith, and that's what I was raised in. I was raised going to church on Sunday, Sunday school. God was always in the house. There was never a doubt whether there was a God or there wasn't a God. And in Florida, when I was going through school, I didn't fit in. At school, I was the kid who was out in the playground separate. I didn't hang out with the other kids. I just didn't get along. I did not fit in. I was never comfortable. Where I was comfortable was at the stables, riding horses, interacting with animals. I was diagnosed in Florida with learning disabilities, and in that day and age, in the 60s, dyslexia was unknown of. They had just started figuring out that somebody with dyslexia learned different. I wasn't retarded. I wasn't mentally damaged. I'm wired differently. But the schools put me in those other categories. So that also set me apart from my classmates. When we moved to California, the aerospace industry was done. My dad had worked at Cape Canaveral. He got laid off, and my parents went to go find out where our next adventure was, whether it was going to be in Texas or California, because that's where you go if you're in aerospace. And they came out here and they found this wonderful place called Santa Maria. And they, more importantly, they found Orchid. And they came back to Florida and they said, we're moving. We're going to move to California. And I had just turned 10, and for my 10th birthday, I got a guinea pig. And we had a cat, and I had turtles, and I had an aquarium, and all these little critters, and all the wild animals that you can save in Florida. There's a lot of them. But when my mom come and said, okay, we're going to have to find homes for Snowflake and for Sweetie Pie, and we're going to, you know, and we're moving, my response was no. And I gathered up all my critters, and I ran away from home. And I went out to the Palmetto Swamp area, which that's where we had our forts. There wasn't a lot of trees in Florida. And I had my guinea pig, I had my cat, and I had my two turtles. And that's where I was going to live. Nope, you aren't taking my family. That was my family. And my dad came out and found me. And he said, no, honey. That's your family. We're going to find a way to take them with us. And he was an important part of my stability. He built a cage for my guinea pig, and he told mom that, you know, we're taking this guinea pig with us across country. We drove from Florida to California with a guinea pig, a doped up cat because he was crazy, and two turtles. And that was our road trip, my brother and yes. And we made it. We made it out to California. And I thought out here it's going to be different. You know, they don't know how stupid I am. They don't know that I was off in special schools and special rooms for my teaching. They don't know. So when I went to Joe Nightingale School, and when we left Florida, we were on long addition and subtraction. And when I got to Joe Nightingale, they were starting long division. So not only was dealing with the dyslexia, but I was way, way, way behind. You know, in the education department, you don't go to it. You know, here I am, I talk funny. Everybody around me was from a different area, so I had this, when people asked me where I was from, it was, well, I'm from Florida. So I got this crazy accent of South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, all mixed up because I grew up with all these different accents. I'm way behind in school. I'm the new kid in the school. And then I'm the tallest kid in the school. And so it's like, yeah, let's fit in. Yeah. You guys, it's okay. You know, I stick out like a sore thumb, but it's okay. And it just got bad. It got really bad. I got transferred from school to school until they finally settled me in Pine Grove. And I was in a classroom. I had Down syndrome. I had deaf. I had Tourette's. Cerebral palsy. You know, it was a catch-all. I was in an educationally handicapped classroom. So everybody knew I was one of them. And that was my elementary school. It was horrific. I struggled. I struggled with fitting in. The recesses, I went out against the back fence. I didn't want anything to do with you. I literally went out and I could see how many of the little white little flowers, and they had a purple middle, how many of those I could pick on recess. And that was my friendships. You know, I went home, I had my guinea pig, I had my cat. And my parents had said when we moved that, you know, we'll see what we can do about getting that horse that we talked about. And it was like, okay, this is my life. This is my life. I am not going to fit in. I'm not going to be a part of. I am going to be that person. I push you away. I don't want you to get to know me. I do not want to be a part of anything. I cannot count on you. The abandonment from being adopted. I always knew I was adopted. So the abandonment from, you know, my biological mother kicked me to the curb. all that stuff just was right there. And I was like, oh. And I hated myself. I absolutely hated myself. But I knew I couldn't kill myself because the pastor and the church had told me that suicide is the one unforgivable sin. I was like, okay. So I'm just going to trudge through. I'm just going to manage. I'm just going to go to school just one more day, get home from school, go play with the critters, just one more day, go to bed, get up, just one more day. And that was my life until I got the wonderful release of finding the horse of my dreams. I had saved money since I was 5.5 years old and introduced to horses. I had ironed handkerchiefs, pulled weeds, done anything that a kid could do to save and to earn this money. And at 11 and a half years old, I had saved $310. That is a fortune. And we had looked for horses, and you know, there was these horses and that horse and that horse and that horse, and this old cowboy that rest his soul, that helped, that got with the stable manager over there, because where we were living there, he had this little stable. And Benny Young said, "I got a horse for you." And he said the magic words, "But I don't know if you can handle it. Watch me. Watch me." Because that has been it. You know, you can't do that. You can't do this. Watch me. And that mare and I became best friends. She was my everything. I would go to the stables before I would go to school, and we'd have long talks. I'd say, "I'll be home. I'll be home. I'll be home." I'd come, go to school, and I had something to look forward to. She was the light in my life. She was an amazing horse. Did I end up on the ground? Yeah. Was she way too much for me? Definitely. But I grew into her. She taught me lessons of trust, of unconditional love, of patience, and don't mess with her. And that was the first time that I actually thought that I was here for a reason, because this critter loved me. She just absolutely, and I was okay. When I was on her, with her, nobody could mess with me. All the bullies at school, they didn't exist. I had a horse. I'd be out on the playground, they'd be going, "Oh yeah, look at the retarded kid. It's okay, I got a horse." Yeah, it's the big bus. I rode the short bus. Yes, I was on the short bus. The short bus would always drop, you know, I'd get home first. And I made sure, such a bitch. I made sure. Bus dropped me off. I was stripping off clothes, going up the stairs. I was throwing on my stable clothes, and I was out. Because the regular bus went right by the stables. So that bus came by the stables, and here I was, just loping around the arena going, "I may be the retarded kid to y'all, but this girl is my center of my attention, and she loves me. You can't mess with that. You cannot take that away." And that, I believe, was the salvation of taking me so that I didn't go so far down the rabbit hole, where I didn't kill myself, where I learned the beginning of being okay with being okay. Through high school, the ag program saved me. I got to be mainstreamed. I did my best. I learned how to read because my cousin sent me a real book. I wasn't interested in any books, if they didn't have pictures, of course, of critters, but he sent me this wonderful book by James Herriot, All Creatures Great and Small, about a country vet. It had no pictures in it, and it was required reading at veterinary college where he was going. And I learned how to really read and absorb through that book. And then it went further on through all of James Herriot's books. I got myself out of that retard, handicap, educationally screwed up mode by doing the things that were given to me, the tools. You know, I did not realize, looking back on my life, I see it now, but I didn't back then. They basically told me that, yeah, you'll never amount to anything. You'll never get it, be able to read. I love reading. I love reading, and it's because I was given things that I could relate to. In high school, I partied like an animal. We had some hellacious parties. Rigetti, yay. Kegger parties at Waller Park. On a regular basis, there was a kegger party at Waller Park on every Friday. I belonged to FFA, and I smoked cigarettes, which is a no-no. These two cowboys that I idolized, Paul Mullen and Benny Young, I wanted to be like them. I wanted to ride like them. They were just amazing horsemen. And what I picked up from them also was that they both smoked Palmel non-filter and Camel non-filter. And they drank Coors Light. And they had glass bottles of brown liquid underneath their seats and their trucks, early times. And I wanted to be like them. So, you know, I would steal their cigarettes. That's what I started smoking on. And I'd steal their beer, and it was usually warm. But I liked the feeling, that combination of horse and that, and giving me the release of not being with those people, you know, those people that did not like me. I craved it. And in high school, it grew even more. I would wad up my FFA jacket underneath my arm, and I'd go out front, and I'd smoke cigarettes. I smoked weed. You know, it was wonderful. The black things,
Black
beauties. Yeah, them babies. Black beauties, because in that era, everybody's mom was on a diet, and they gave them a great big old bottle of black beauties, and we all stole them. If you wanted to get a little bit more drunk, you know, then you had the bottle of Valium in mommy and daddy's medicine cabinet, so we had those. But I didn't like being me, so I had learned to medicate myself to do anything I could to not be me. I made it through high school, amazingly. I made it through high school. I got to graduate. The all-night party, I don't remember any of it. Disney trip, 1977, went to Disneyland with a senior trip. Don't remember a bit of it. Have no clue. We had mushrooms. Sorry. I had learned how to walk with a half pint on either side of my boot. So when we went on the bus to go to Disneyland, you know, I got 2 pints. And they always would ask me at the liquor store, you know, why do you want a half pint? Why don't you just, because, you know. I missed that part of my life. I look back now and it's like, you know, have you ever been to Disneyland? Kind of, but no. Don't remember it. Have no idea. You know, I got a picture of myself with Eeyore on grad night. Don't remember it. Have no clue. But I had no, you know, what I wanted to do with life and what my dream was to be a veterinarian. And I wanted to be a large animal veterinarian, or else I wanted to be an ag teacher. And at this point in time, at the end of high school, doing the very best that I could with my scholastic ability, it was not in the cards. It was absolutely not in the cards, surely not veterinarian. So I did the next best thing. I got the waitressing job and I partied with the older people. I looked older. I started going to Elmer's when I was probably 19. We were hanging out at the scoreboard. We would ride our 10-speed to the scoreboard and ride our horses to the scoreboard, which used to be, it's the Thai place now on Foster Road. And we'd tie our horses up out back and we could get pitchers of beer. We looked older. I looked older. And when we got pitchers of beer, I never asked for a glass. Why do you need a glass? You got the pitcher. That's a big mug. If you poured it into the glass and then if you're drinking out of the pitcher, nobody's going to want any. So in going to these places and fitting in and being a part of, I had come into myself and I was hanging out at Elmer's so much that the owner had asked me, one of the gals had an appointment during the day and she asked me if I could cover a shift. I was like, yeah, sure, no problem. So I covered that shift and then I started picking up shifts at Elmer's on a regular basis. Then I became a regular bartender. And just under a year later, when I celebrated my 21st birthday, she was a little she was like, oh, it's your birthday. Oh, what are you, 24, 23? No, I'm 21 now. And almost lost that job over that one. But she was like, well, thank God you're legal now. So, but I had found my niche. I had found a place where I could fit in. I could find a place where y'all liked me because I had the booze. So if you didn't treat me nicely, I would short shot you. I would take my time getting to you. I would shortchange you. I had control back here. I had no control in my head over my feelings or emotions. None. I knew that you all hated me and that you thought that I was just a piece of dirt because of where I came from and because my biological mother didn't want me and because I was retarded and because I was this and because I was that. But I controlled the booze. So therefore, I wasn't as bad as what I thought I was. And I liked it. I liked it. And I continued that path. I continued bartending. And I bartended at some really nice places over the years. I decided that Santa Maria was a problem. And so I did a road trip. We call it geographical. And that the problems were here in Orchid, or there in Orchid. And so there was an opportunity for me to head to New Hampshire. So New Hampshire would be someplace different. I could reinvent myself and nobody there would know who I was. And so I could be anybody I wanted and I could do anything I wanted. And so off we went on a road trip to New Hampshire. We had so much weed. We smoked a joint. It started out that we were going to do at state borders. And that didn't work, so we went county lines. And every time we saw a California plate. And then that wasn't good enough. And so then every time we saw a plate that started had a C in it, it was like, C, cool, light it up. And it actually was a really wonderful 6 weeks of my life. That road trip was just amazing. I got back to New Hampshire and I found out something that I brought me with me. And I still was partying the way I was and I was getting into trouble. They, in New Hampshire, did not understand. They had never heard of a tequila slammer. And tequila slammer is when you take a shot of tequila and you put a little ginger ale in it and you slam it down and pound it and you can do a whole bunch of them all really quick. And these East Coast people didn't understand the effects of tequila. And there was a beer bar right down the way from us. And so, here I go with my boots, walking with my half pints in them. And they're all, drinking their beer like normies. And it's like, let's hit the bathroom. Let me show you something. And their weed sucked. It really did. First time and I'm sorry that drugs are a part of my story. First time that I did a California pinner, they were like, God, she's all tight with the weed. And then they all shut up. I mean, they couldn't finish it. They were used to this junk stuff and they were like, damn, no wonder. I was there for a period of time, and after a few fights, disagreements, broken bottles, mugs, whatever, state police decided that I should probably leave and go back to California. They didn't know my name really, but they knew that I was a girl from California, and I was the one that every time there was a fight at this bar, I was there. And that somehow tequila bottles ended up all over the place, and that people wrecked their cars, that these good kids of the New Hampshire Basin were being corrupted by this girl from California. Okay. So I packed my cat up and drove back to Santa Maria. I'm welcome from Fresno. I did 4 years in Fresno. God bless you. I did another geographical, and I went to Fresno because I had to get the heck out of Orchid because it was all Orchid's problem. And I ended up over in Fresno with a wonderful job at a horse ranch, managing it. It was great. The owner said, you can't drink on the property. You can't drink on the property. I was like, yeah, no problem. That's not a problem. No drugs, no alcohol. And I was like, okay, fine. And within a couple of weeks, I knew where the dope was. I was drinking like a damn fish. I found Jim's place within 4 days. Love that place. That was just that. Yeah, they drank like I drank. And I was asked to leave this job, and I don't really understand why. I mean, she came in the morning, and there was like beer cans all over the cute little pond, and there was a guy passed out on the front lawn, and well, there was a guy passed out in one of the stalls. Yeah, we had a hell of a party. Totally had a party out there. And I got too drunk, and I passed out, and we weren't able to clean it up. And I had to pack up and leave. And it was not my fault, you know. This was my life. This was my life. I also got my first DUI in Fresno. I got my second DUI within a week later because I was ticked off at Fresno because it was all Fresno's fault. Sorry. And so on the way back over here to the coast to snivel, gripe, bitch, and complain, and pass the Robles, they didn't like the fact that I was drinking a beer going down 101, so I got my second DUI. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful for those. Never been to jail. I got to go to jail in Paso Robles and enjoyed it. I got to do 48 hours, and they told me I could bring in 10 packs of cigarettes. For 24 hours, I had 10 packs of cigarettes. So I looked at it and said, yeah, I'll bring in, yeah, no problem. I had room service. I had my own room. I had whatever, you know, it was like, okay, fine. The gal took her mattress off of the one bunk. She took it over there, pack of cigarettes. I enjoyed that 48 hours. That was my first taste of what jail was. But I didn't have a problem. I came back to Santa Maria. I had to get out of Fresno because it was all Fresno's fault. I got back here and I got back into bartending. And I found this wonderful thing called methamphetamine. Hitler's marching drug. God, I love that stuff. You know, here the booze made me shorter and it made me skinnier and I could fit in and I could dance and I could do this and I could do that. And yeah, life was good. And this stuff just took it and just slammed that accelerator down, and it took me down a rabbit hole that I am so blessed that I'm able to put a sentence together. I was introduced to it by a boyfriend, but he wouldn't teach me how to smoke it because he smoked it. So when he went to jail, his best friend taught me all the ins and outs of everything. And I became quite the business person. That boyfriend went, he had to go. He was too needy and he just, yeah, no, he wanted my stuff. And I came up with this business proposition for myself. you bartend and you can sling dope and you can make a bunch of money. Because all the people who are drinking and you're controlling their drinking, you can control other things. And it was one heck of a deal. And it was one heck of a ride. I had money in my pocket. I had friends. I had people that liked me. And I thought I had made it. But I still was empty inside, you know, and these parents, and all through all of this, my parents were, they didn't know what was wrong with their daughter. They had no idea what was wrong with their daughter. I would come in and out of their lives. I would show up for Christmas. I showed up Christmas Eve with a couple of drunk cowboys. Couldn't introduce them to my parents because I didn't know their names, but you know, I just come blasting in and then I disappear and I come blasting in. Numerous times I would come home to find a note on my front door. Hey, Sarah, Dad's in the hospital. Can you call? Messages on my voicemail, you know, the old voice, the old machines. If you don't call and let us know you're alive, we're going to have to report you missing. Haven't heard from you in 3 months. Are you still alive? Painful one was when I got one, because that was Mom. Mom was just, she was always like that. Dad was the calm, stood back and was like, okay, what's going on? And the most painful message was when he called and said, hey, your mom's really worried. Can you call me? I was like, holy cow. You know, and that was my life. This is the damage that I did to my family. My brother had gotten off and he had gotten married to a wonderful gal. He had two boys. I wasn't invited to his wedding. I found out later about it. First one, Zach. I found out Zach actually existed, my first nephew, when he was 6 months old. When he was coming for Christmas. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, we haven't talked to you in a while. Your brother's coming, and oh, they're bringing their baby. What? I just wasn't a part of their life. And the garbage and the hell that I put my family through. Because we just have this small little family. It's my brother, and it's me, and it was my parents. And then his wife and their two kids. I mean, it's a small little nucleus of a family. And it just, there was no way that I can ever, ever, ever make what happened better. There was no way. What happened is, and I'm so grateful for it. I can honestly stand here and say I am grateful for Santa Maria Police Department and I am grateful for the Sheriff's Department. They came and they kicked down my door. They knew that there was somebody in the area that had large quantities of something, but they couldn't figure out where it was coming from and they didn't know. And a friend came over the night previously and she had sold me a half ounce and I was like, yeah, cool, yay. So when they came and they knocked on the door, kind of. Okay, they kicked in the door. The door came off the hinges. It was ugly. Gun in the face, the whole thing, and they're like, where's a half ounce? I knew who it was. And I knew who it was, and that's super important. You know, for me, it was super important later on. I went through the court. They found that. That was not everything that I had in house, but they thought that it was. So after my boyfriend at the time, I called him. He was supposed to come over and take care of all my animals because I had a menagerie. And what he did instead, my boyfriend of 8 years, he called up my parents who he had never met. He couldn't be bothered with. And he told them, your daughter just got busted. I'm not going near the place. Animals are gonna starve. And my dad was like, well, who is this? This is her ex-boyfriend. Click. They came down to the substation, and they had to figure out what a bail bondsman was. They don't do that. They're socialites. They don't. They know how to play bridge. They know how to have cocktail parties. Mom knows how to play tennis. Dad shoots trap. You know, they're that kind of people. And they had to figure out how to bail their daughter out of jail. And no sooner had they bailed me out and got me home, but as they were leaving, I was back on the stuff because I got what they missed. And I tried to kill myself with it. I had 3/4 of an ounce, and I had a bottle of Jack Daniels, and I tried to do everything I could. I consumed as much as I could, and I couldn't get loaded. I could not get loaded. And you know, I'd like to say that that was the end, but it wasn't. Had to go through all the court stuff. And I got sentenced to 21 days and then on electronic monitoring. Courts didn't think I had a problem. They didn't think that the fact that I had 3 DUIs underneath my belt, that I was higher than a kite, that I had all kinds of paraphernalia, no. I had a business problem. So after the 21 days in jail, I got out, and as my parents backed out of the driveway right before Christmas, they had dropped off Christmas, picked me up, Christmas presents, and they were going to Idaho to be with the grandkids and my brother and his wife. And as they're backing out, after me being in jail and all that, taking the top off of that handle of Jack Daniels, I got what I need all prepped up, and I'm watching them back out of my apartment, and I'm doing it all over again. I had no clue how to stop. I had no idea that you could actually breathe without being loaded. I'd never danced sober. I didn't know how to barbecue. I didn't know how to drive, really. Bartending, I had been medicating myself since I was probably 13 years old with something or another. They took off, and that was the worst time. I wanted to stop. And what finally happened is that they took me back into custody. I threw dirties. Yeah, I was trying to clean up by using bleach and milk, baking soda. Yeah, no, that'll clean you out. That's colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. But this is how I was cleaning up, because I needed to keep. And they came and arrested me, and I had this little job hanging racks over at the Rad Thrift Store. And they arrested me in back of the Rad Thrift Store, and I was like, holy cow. You know, I had just, that morning, I was all numbed up because I had been to the dentist, and he had dug out all the broken teeth that a meth addict has. All the teeth, they got to dig out those roots and all of that. And so I am just like, I'm swelled up. My lips are still numb. The poor manager there, he's like, well, how can I help? I want to see it. So I'm handcuffed, and he's trying to hold my lips together around a cigarette because it was like, that's it. I'm going to prison. Do not pass go. That's what I was told. They took me into custody. My parents had to come down to the substation, and my dad looked through the plexiglass window, and mom said, that's it, we're done. We're calling animal control. They're taking all your cats and all your critters. That's a lot of freaking critters. And the thrift store is going to come clean out your house. We're done. And I was so empty, and I had nothing. I had absolutely nothing. And my dad came up to the plexiglass. I'm a daddy's girl. I always have been. He came up to the plexiglass. He put his hand on the plexiglass. I put my hand up. And he asks me, he says, are you done yet? This man has never been around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. He doesn't know what, you know, are you done yet? This isn't something that would come out of his mouth. And my reply back to him was, God, please, yes, I need help. I don't know how to do this. I've never surrendered. I've fought. I've bounced my own bars. You don't met. Are you kidding me? And I'm done. I am just so done. And Dad said, let's ride this out. Let's see what's going on. And the DA had told me that if I messed up on electronic monitoring, that I was going to be going to prison. And I think it was like a 3 or 4 year over my head. And so it was like, okay, fine. I went to Santa Barbara, and I got housed in the basement. Nice place, really nice place. Great, great place. But it was perfect. It was absolutely perfect. And the first night there, they had the Women of Alcoholics came in, H and I came in, and they had a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't understand what they were saying, but I knew they looked good and they smelled good, and they were smiling. And the gal had a purple rose in her hair. And after everything was all said and done, she gave me her hardcover book, which you don't get hardcovers in jail. And she took the petals, and she gave us all petals of that rose. And I was like, that's really cool. You know, that's neat. Okay. I got invested into the STP program. There's a wonderful counselor, Chuck and Bob. Love those two men. They saved my life. Or as Chuck would say, I helped you save your own life. I found this program. I was introduced to this book that was written before I was written that had me in it. I was different. I was an addict alcoholic. Alcoholics are in the gutter. Addicts have a little bit of class. I'm an addict alcoholic. Damn it, don't you know? But I found me in that book, and I found that it started with alcohol. Doesn't matter how much drugs. Somebody told me that at the bottom of every bottle is a sack. That is a true fact for me. Somebody told me that when they take the cap off that bottle, they throw it away because they won't need it. That is a fact for me. I heard stuff in jail with the women bringing the meetings in that I heard it, and I listened, and I started taking stuff in. Chuck told me that you should make a gratitude list. What the hell? I'm in jail. Why? He said, find stuff to find grateful that you're grateful for now, because you can use that list later on. I have. On release from jail, I got out. I had been there a bit. The judge, instead of sending me to prison, he told me that I would have a 6-year tail hanging over my head, and I had 6 years probation. That's a lot of probation. That's very expensive probation. I got released, and I had a big bag of stuff because I had been there a while. If you've never been to jail, you don't understand the big plastic bag that you walk out of. And I'm like, okay, you know, and my parents, 46 years old, and my parents are coming to pick me up from jail. And Chuck comes out the door, and he's like, awesome. God's showing off in my life. He goes, so what are you going to do? What do you mean, what am I going to do? Well, we're going to go to IHOP. I want scrambled egg. I want over easy. I want coffee. I want. He says, no, what are you going to do? Now that you're out of jail, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to go home with my critters. No. What do you need to do for yourself today? I need to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to go to a meeting. He said, okay, how are you going to do that? I said, I'm going to go to the club and I'm going to get a schedule because you said I should. Okay. Now, Grant, yeah, IHOP, we hit IHOP, best coffee in the world. And in that, I went to go use the bathroom and I ended up sobbing my eyes out because there was a door on the bathroom. Toilet paper was on the wall. They got paper towel dispenser. The mirror was glass. It wasn't that shiny metal stuff. The coffee was brewed. I've never had such a wonderful cup of coffee in my whole life. I'm still chasing that cup of coffee. But I'm grateful for those little things. And on the way back into town, I had an apartment up here. We're coming this way. Like, we got to stop by the 1600 Club. Well, don't you want to go home for? No, got to stop the 1600 Club. Stopped here, pulled up here. There are people outside here. I was like, okay, put my big girl panties on, and I'm going to go in there, and I'm going to get me a schedule. Because I was scared. I didn't think you guys wanted me here. Knowing what I did and the lifestyle that I led and the trash that I had caused, no. People who were here said, oh, yeah, we'll get you scheduled. There'll be a meeting here pretty soon. Why don't you stay? Like, no. No, I'll be back. And one of the guys said, sure you will be. No, I'll be back. I went home, loved all my critters. My parents left. It was up to me to get my tail to this meeting, and I came to that meeting that night at happy hour. The table's right here. I walked in that door, my knees were knocking so hard I couldn't breathe. I was scared to death. And, oh yeah, I rode my bicycle over here. I'm that cool. You know, I had my bicycle. And I had a key to a bicycle lock, and I had a key to my apartment because my parents kept the apartment for me. They kept that apartment for me while I was in jail. They took care of my critters. They fed my cats. They fed my turtles. They didn't know either. They bought crickets for my turtles and frogs. Dad's cool. But I came back to that meeting, and the woman was sitting here that used to be one of my customers. And I wondered where she was. She was a really good customer. She bought a lot of my goodies. And she was sitting there, and she pulled a chair out, and she goes, what the fuck took you so long? Okay. I sat my tail down, and I was right up against, you know, here's this tough gal that bounced around bars and didn't take garbage from anything. And I'm, like, leaning on her. And she's like, it's okay. I says, well, I don't know what to do. And she said, just breathe. Breathe in, breathe out. Okay. And when I was instructed by Chuck, she says, "You, when they ask for anybody for 30 days and under, he goes, raise your hand and introduce yourself. I said, well, I got more than 30 days. He says, I don't care. They don't know that. And you haven't been there 30 days. So you start your 30 days of announcing when you get there, your first meeting. And I did. I did what I was suggested to do. I did what this was my life. And from somebody who was called a retarded kid, and worthless, and just a piece of garbage. You guys loved me. And the old timers here, holy cow, Tony West, whoo! He had an attitude. I miss that guy, little Italian stallion dude on a Harley. Oh, I'd be like, well, I had a bad day at work. Shut up, you're working, aren't you? Yeah, and shut up. Yeah, I went back to that thrift store, and the manager was nice enough to say, yeah, come back. He told my parents, he says, yeah, tell her to come back. I'll kick her ass, and then I'll put her back on the timesheet. And that's what he did. I went back in there. He goes, turn around. He kicked me in the butt, and he said, okay, you'll be here tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Okay. And I worked there, and I got my life. You know, I didn't pay the last DUI. I'm not going to give the county any money. I just waited till they didn't, you know, you wait enough time and they can't collect it, so. I got to get my license back. I hadn't had a license for like 12 years. Oops. And I worked at that job, and I worked the best that I could, and I worked with a guy who was a very good example of a practicing alcoholic. He smelled like stale beer and urine. And he was on the truck with me, and he called me the B and the C word, and he's still alive today. I did not kill him, and that's because of these steps. I worked the steps in jail, and I worked them to the best of my ability. I came out, and I worked them with my sponsor. In recovery, in sobriety, I had trudged through some pretty significant things. I think I had 3.5 years, and I was diagnosed with cancer. And I had to go through the surgery, and I had to go through some stuff. And I came through the other end, and it's like, holy cow, awesome. Didn't have to drink or use. I lost the job at the thrift store. Oops. I got the job back. They hired me back. I got injured at that job. And it was a significant injury that caused a whole bunch of pain. I had a roll-up door on the thrift store truck come down and smack me on the head as I was stepping up in. And And so then I was no longer working there, and I had to learn how the job wasn't me. That wasn't my worth. I came to a lot of meetings. I went through the neck fusion surgery. That was life-changing. It was absolutely life-changing. I quit smoking, and nobody died. I had to. My sponsor has a little bit less than a year than I do in sobriety, and when she was coming up on a year of not smoking, she was like, yeah, I'm coming up on a year. I was like, shit, now I gotta quit. But I've kept that, and I use the steps to stop smoking. My father, who has been my hero all of my life, you know, he built that cage so I could bring my best friend, my guinea pig. He had congenital heart failure, and he had Parkinson's, and he was failing. He was failing fast. My mother had a stroke, and so I'm juggling mom in the hospital and dad at home. And dad can't go to the hospital and visit mom because he's in such rough shape, and they don't know what's going on with her, and they're having problems with her. And so it's like, and I'm in the middle of it, and Alcoholics Anonymous is right there with me. I got the women of Alcoholics Anonymous blowing up my phone. I'm sitting in the hospital room with my mom, and my phone's going, zoop, zoop, zoop. And she's really deaf, and she's like, I keep hearing a bee. Is that a bee? Like, yeah, it's a bee, Mom. When he was on hospice, I was the one who was given the gift of being in charge of his medication. I was administering the liquid morphine and the Ativan and giving him the cocktail every 4 hours. I was setting my clock, my little cell phone alarm on my flip phone, missed my flip phone, you know, for every 4 hours so that I could be there. I slept on an old army cot right by my father's bed. And I got to see him leave this world. I got to see him take his last breath, and I got to see him have a tear that rolled down his eyes, just right down his face. And I got to see him go to God. And I didn't have to drink or use. And my God has a sense of humor. I mean, come on, the alcoholic and the addict, everybody else is normies in my family. So let's give the addict the liquid morphine. Let's send the alcoholic to the store to go get the cases of wine for the reception at the house. But I'm able to do these things because I have this spiritual connection with a God that's beyond my understanding. I've seen people walk through stuff. I watched my brother and sister-in-law walk through the death of her two sons as a result of this disease. In Colorado, the family ranch, they have what's called a fish pond. Yes, there's fish in it. I fished in that thing. Not after this, though. But they were out there drinking. Her older son had several DUIs. He wasn't supposed to be driving. And he told me that Christmas that I was up there, when he's handing me the Jack Daniels, and I'm like, no thanks, I don't drink. He goes, oh, why not? Are you one of those AA people or something stupid like that? I said, yeah, I am. Oh, that shit doesn't work. That doesn't work. Yeah, I was supposed to do that. It doesn't work. He wanted to save his younger brother, who had jumped in to this pond to go swimming after a night of drinking and bonfire. And his younger brother was struggling and screaming out for help, I guess. But everybody jumped in to try to get Weldon out. And everybody came out of that pond, except for those two boys. Ben and Weldon died, direct result of alcoholism. Their alcohol content was off the hook. I went back to Colorado, and you got two caskets. You got two FFA jackets. You got boots. You got this whole little small town there to bury these two boys. You know, we went out to the cemetery, and it's country. It's country. It's as country as you could bet. I look city folk out there. And they lower the caskets down with ropes, with roping ropes. They lower the caskets down. They put the top on. And then everybody grabs a shovel. There's a whole stack of dirt. And all you can hear is complete silence except for the people with the shovels the metal, and in this pile of dirt, there's small rocks. So it's a bump. And they buried those two boys, shovel after shovel after shovel. And all I could think of is, why did they stop digging before they ended up at the bottom of the grave? And at that party afterwards, there was Jack Daniels and there was a keg in every corner out there. There was bottles going around, and all I did, I'm looking at this and I'm uncomfortable as all get out. Like, how many more are they going to have to bury before this little community realizes they got an alcohol problem, big alcohol program. They have one meeting a week, and everybody signs their own court cards because AA doesn't work. And I wanted to scream, yeah, it does. My parents got a daughter back, my brother got a sister back, and I got a life. To wrap this up real quick, my brother did get married again to Elin, love her to death. And I was his best person, man, whatever. He said, I'm not getting married without you by my side. And he is... We are friends. We are tight. We are tight. If you're on a court card and you're not done drinking, good luck. Hope your parents don't have to bury you. This program works. I cannot imagine my life without it. I have this life that I did not ever believe that I deserved, nor would I have ever dreamed of it. So get yourself a sponsor, work the steps, and please, please don't ever get too smart for this program. I'll say this and shut up. Yeah, I know it's Joseph. That gal who gave me the rose petals, years later, she showed up in detox and she asked me to be her sponsor because she stopped doing what we do around here, which is going to meetings and doing stuff. And getting, you know, and working the steps and working this program. Her mother had to bury her because she left detox and her life got too busy and she got too far away from the program. And she was found with a needle in her arm. I still have those rose petals. And they're very cherished. They're very cherished. Don't ever get too smart for this program. If you think that there's a better program, there is. It's over there on Stoll and College. And you never have to drink again once you go in there. It's a guarantee. It's called the cemetery. And that is the truth. Thanks.